First of all, I would like to welcome everyone to tonight's event, and thank you for coming. Tonight, Students Confronting Apartheid by Israel will renew its call for Stanford University to divest from companies that violate international law and contribute to human rights abuses in Israel and the occupied territories. And to introduce myself, my name is Jenna Queenan. I am the president of Students Confronting Apartheid by Israel. So, we will begin tonight's presentation with a kind of 30-minute presentation by Omer Shaker on Sky's divestment campaign, to be followed by comments on the importance of divestment from Joel Bainan, Khalil Barhoum, and Cecily Saraski, whom I will introduce in a minute. We will end with time for questions, so I ask all of you to please be respectful tonight and hold your questions until the end. I would also like to note that tonight is just the beginning of our campaign and what we hope to be an extensive conversation at Stanford. We are therefore planning on holding a town hall tentatively on May 3rd, although we will be sending out more information once we finalize details on the location. So we invite any and all interested parties from Stanford to attend. And I will now introduce tonight's speakers. So, first, Omer Shaker, currently pursuing his JD at Stanford University's School of Law, completed his master's degree in Arab Studies from Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, where he held the prestigious Khaled Jufali Scholarship and his BA from Stanford with honors in international relations. A 2007-2008 Fulbright Scholar in Syria, his academic work has focused on contemporary politics and human rights in the Arab world. Omer also studied at Oxford and in Morocco and Cairo, and spearheaded humanitarian projects in Syria, Jordan, and the West Bank. At Stanford, he has been actively involved in student organizations related to law and the Middle East, serving on the executive board of the International Law Society, president of MSAN in the year it was named Organization of the Year by ASSU, and founder and president of Sky at one point. He also served on the undergraduate Senate in 2004, and in recognition for his contributions, Omer received Stanford's 2006 James Lyons Service Award. Dr. Khalil Barhoum was born in Bethlehem, Palestine. He came to the U.S. on a Rotary International Scholarship and received his master's and PhD in linguistics from Georgetown University in 1985. Upon graduating from Georgetown, he joined Stanford University and taught in the Department of Linguistics. Currently, he is co-founder of the Program of African and Middle Eastern Languages and Literatures in the Division of Cultures, Literatures, and Languages at Stanford University. Dr. Barhoum is a former president of the Association of Arab American University Graduates and has served twice as the president of its California chapter. He is a frequent visitor to the Middle East and is a keen observer of its societies, politics, and cultures. Next, Joel Bainan is the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History and Professor of Middle East History at Stanford University. His research and writing focus on the modern and contemporary Egypt, Israel, Palestine, the Arab-Israeli conflict, political Islam, and U.S. policy in the Middle East. He has taught Middle East history at Stanford since 1983. In 2001-2002, he served as president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America. From 2006 to 2008, he served as director of Middle East Studies and professor of history at the American University in Cairo. His most recent book is a co-edited volume with Frederic Varel entitled Social Movements, Mobilization, and Contestation in the Middle East and North Africa, which will be published by Stanford University Press next month. Last, Cecily Saraski is the granddaughter of labor Zionist activists and the deputy director of Jewish Force for Peace, the country's largest Jewish grassroots group dedicated to a just peace between Israelis and Palestinians based on democracy and full equal rights for both peoples. Cecily joined the staff of JBP in 2003 as part of a Ford Foundation Human Rights Fellowship following 15 years working with NGOs on advocacy communications. A video maker, former newspaper columnist, and talk radio host, Cecily's analysis of Israel-Palestine politics has appeared in numerous media outlets around the world. Cecily graduated from Brown University with a BA in Religious Studies, with special honors for her work in modern culture and media. She is the editor of Muzzle Watch, JVP's acclaimed blog documenting efforts to silence open debate about Israel-Palestine policy, and leads JVP's fundraising, media, and online outreach efforts. So now I'm going to turn it over to Omar, and after that we will be receiving comments from our panel.
Thank you all for coming. I want to say especially to thank you all because I know this topic can be one that's very emotional to some, and sometimes just getting into the door can be tough to do. So I want to really thank everybody for doing that. And really what my goal in this presentation is to do is to really simply explain what divestment is all about, what it is we're actually articulating here in our campaign, and then to hopefully open it up for an engaging dialogue and discussion with our panel. But I want to begin by acknowledging the unique moment that we're really in the Middle East. Across the region, we see grassroots, people-led movements, tired of the status quo, tired of waiting for their rulers to bring reform to their societies, saying enough, and standing up and demanding their rights. And it really was a similar impetus that led to the start of the international boycott, sanctions, and divestment movement in the context of Israel and Palestine. It was churchgoers, union leaders, students who said, after 20 years of a peace process that has not brought peace and has been much more about process than anything else, that we're tired of waiting for the political process to bring a better future to the Middle East, and we're ready to work for it ourselves. So they went to their universities, they went to their churches, they went to their unions, and they've directly taken action to help bring a better peace of future peace and justice to the Middle East. So what we're doing here at Stanford is we're calling for an end to the university's investment and corporations that profit from human rights violations in Israel and Palestine. So we call on Stanford to divest from companies that violate human rights and violate international law in doing one of these four activities. So really the goal of this presentation is I'm going to go through them one by one, explain what each of these activities really means, explain why it's in violation of international law, and give examples of companies that we're calling for the university to divest from. So first, we call on Stanford to divest from companies that operate on illegally occupied land. Describing what occupied land means requires a little bit of history, but with the permission of Dr. Bainan, we've reduced the history of Israel and Palestine down to a single slide. So the most important message that really we want to convey in this slide is that this isn't a thousand-year-old conflict. This isn't, you know, peoples that have been fighting for you know, since the beginning of time. It's really a contemporary struggle about land, resources, and human rights. Most would date the beginning of the conflict with the end of the 19th century and the formation of Zionism, a secular political movement in the face of serious repression against Jews of Europe. From 1882 to 1946, we saw large waves of Jewish immigrants move from Europe to the land of historic Palestine, led by the Jewish National Fund and the Jewish Colonization Society. By 1946, under a British mandate, the Jewish community in Palestine owned 6 to 7% of the land, compared to the remaining 93%, which was owned by the indigenous Palestinians. In 1947, as you'll see in this map, Great Britain, no longer able to maintain its mandate, referred the issue to the United Nations, which agreed to partition the land into two states, a state of Israel, which would occupy 55% of the land, and the state of Palestine, which would occupy 45% of the land. Of course, the problem was this resolution did not have an enforcement mechanism. And between 1947 and 1949, armed Israeli groups went on the offensive. Now, the historical record, as any of you have taken Dr. Bain's class known, is pretty controversial about what happened during this period, but the results are not. Over 700,000 indigenous Palestinians became refugees, and over 400 Palestinian villages were destroyed. So by 1949, Israel expanded from the original 55% that it had been given by the United Nations to 78% and had kicked out the indigenous population against what was recommended in the UN mandate. Of course, in 1967, as you'll see at the beginning of this map, after the Six-Day War, Israel occupied the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, and the Sinai Peninsula, and set up an occupation infrastructure involving settlements, checkpoints, and the security barrier, reducing the West Bank from a once contiguous piece of land to a series of ghettos and bantustans, small enclaves separated from one another. The biggest development since 1967, of course, has been the construction of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. So what are these Israeli settlements that you hear about on the media? Quite simply, they're defined as an Israeli community built on territory captured in the 1967 war. It's a practice that, as you see above, violates Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prevents an occupying power from transferring its civilian population to territory it occupies during war. And it's also in violation of several resolutions issued by the United Nations. Although Israel has trumped up its withdrawal first from Sinai and then 8,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip, it still has nearly 500,000 between the West Bank and East Jerusalem, settlements that have been there for nearly two-thirds the life of the Israeli state and really represent relatively permanent communities. Now, the biggest thing to understand about why a group names itself Students Confronting Apartheid by Israel is to understand the different legal standing of those Israeli settlers in the West Bank and those Palestinians. Quite simply, there's two systems of law at work. While Israeli settlers hold Israeli citizenship, are protected by Israeli law, can vote in Israeli election, and can freely travel abroad and within the territories and abroad, Palestinians do not have these privileges and remain living under a brutal military occupation. Of course, many would look at this slide and say, well, the difference is obvious. There is a Palestinian Authority. However, the Palestinian Authority lacks any measure of true sovereignty. It has no control over its borders, its airspace, its water space, no military, and really no military kind of. Recently, we've seen the creation of a Palestinian security forces, but its sole mandate is to protect Israel from Palestinians, right? So a state whose entire security mandate is mandated on protecting, providing security for another state. And again, to emphasize the point that Israeli settlements have been there for two-thirds the life of the state. So these aren't temporary structures. As those of you who have been to the territories understand, these are communities that are meant to stay and meant to stay permanently. Of course, it's worth noting that the situation is especially difficult in East Jerusalem. In East Jerusalem, Israel has illegally annexed this land. So Palestinians are denied citizenship. And even in a city that in many cases they've been from for hundreds of years, they're deemed illegal temporary residents. And of course, we understand the situation in Gaza. Well, although Israel has militarily withdrawn, it still maintains effective control, controlling all the access points into the strip, and again, the airspace and the water space. Of course, everyday life and transport represents the greatest challenge of life under occupation. Archbishop and former Nobel Peace Laureate of South Africa, Desmond Tutu, when he visited in 2002, noted how it reminded him so much of the situation in South Africa. And the difficulties of everyday transport have been noted by human rights organizations, both international, Israeli, and Palestinian. Of course, a lot of the situation has changed in recent times, but at the worst point of the occupation several years ago, Israel maintained 700 closure obstacles in the occupied territories. Now, the key thing to understand about these obstacles is they're not located on the green line, or the temporary provisional border between Israel and the land that's occupied in 1967. But in many cases, they're located between Palestinian villages and Palestinian towns. So this sometimes makes a routine commute for a Palestinian going to school or for somebody going to work turn into, a lengthy hour, several hour long ordeal. At these checkpoints, Palestinians are routinely humiliated by teenage Israeli soldiers, which have the fate to determine whether or not they'll make it to school or make it to work on that particular day. But what's important to note is that checkpoints aren't the only part of this transportation infrastructure that makes Palestinian life difficult. There's further a colored ID system. So, for example, Palestinians from Jerusalem hold blue passports, and those from the West Bank hold green passports. And the color of your ID determines sometimes where you can or can't go. So Palestinians, for example, from Bethlehem, which is 10 kilometers from Jerusalem, have never been able, in many cases, to visit Jerusalem because they're not allowed to do so with that color of their ID system. In many cases further, especially when the situation escalates, permits are required from to travel between cities. So I remember when I was in the West Bank in 2005, trying to get from Nablus to Ramallah. We had to switch cabs several times in order to make our trip happen because the driver of the cab didn't have the right permit to continue going forward. So the idea to understand is that these change day by day. I mean, this summer, a lot of the checkpoints have been eased. Many of them have been removed. But any time a situation escalates or becomes more difficult, it can go back to this. So while Palestinians face this system of checkpoints, Israel has constructed a system of roads to facilitate transportation for settlers and soldiers. Now, these roads are explicitly Israeli only. They cannot be used by Palestinians with green IDs, and it basically allows for quick and efficient transport from settlements. So, for example, foreign minister, although he may not be foreign minister for long, Avigdor Lieberman is able to commute every day from a settlement to go into Israel proper, whereas Palestinians trying to get from one town to another, trying to get to school or a hospital, are not allowed to do so. Of course, you can imagine that this kind of system has serious effects on everyday Palestinian life. And it affects many spheres of life. So, for example, trade and foreign investment are especially difficult when you have arbitrary closures and the stoppage of trade and transport. Education, we've seen thousands drop out during the heights of the occupation. So, for example, Bir Zeit, which is the most prominent Palestinian university, was closed from 1987 to 1992 in the midst of the Intifada. Health-wise, we've seen also many consequences. According to a Palestinian health NGO, over 100 Palestinians have died in ambulances because they haven't been able to get to hospitals through checkpoints. So the point of describing all of this about the occupation, about settlements, is to reiterate our call for the university to divest from companies that operate or build facilities on Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. So to give you a couple examples, we call for divestment from the company Ahava. And you might be thinking, a cosmetics company, why would these guys want to have anything to do with a cosmetics company? Well, Ahava operates out of an Israeli settlement near the Dead Sea and actually uses Palestinian resources, which it has stolen, as this is occupied land, to basically build a business model. And this is against the Fourth Geneva Convention, which forbids the use of stolen resources for profit. Moreover, they market their cosmetics as being from the Dead Sea, Israel, something that even Oxfam has criticized them for doing. Ahava often markets that this is a leaf that has nothing to hide, but the reality is they are hiding an occupation and exploitation of resource. The second company we call for divestment for under this criteria is Motorola, which has constructed a radar detector system in over 24 Israeli settlements. Some were built on stolen Palestinian land, and others are currently based on Palestinian land. And they also offer surveillance systems in 16 settlements. Secondly, so that's our first criteria. Our second criteria calls for the university and the board of trustees to ensure it is not invested in companies involved in construction and the maintenance of Israel's separation barrier. The separation barrier was built in Israel by 2002, and Israel cited security as its major motivation. But as you'll notice from this map of the security barrier, it's actually not built on the Green Line, again, the provincial border between the West Bank and Israel proper. It cuts deep into the West Bank and by completion will annex significant chunks of land to Israel. Now, depending on exactly what happens with the Jordan Valley, this could be anywhere from 10% to 15% of the West Bank, all the way, estimates have gone all the way up to 40%. The border, or the Green Line, spans 200 kilometers, but the security barrier is 790. The barrier, which stands four times the length of the Berlin Wall and at parts is over twice the height, is one that has been deemed illegal by the International Court of Justice. To give you just a sense of the size of this structure, this is a picture of me, and I'm not, too short. So, and that's the size of the barrier at one point, which is 25 feet at this area. And it's really ironic when you look at a structure like this and you see the height and the length and you remember how many in this country mourned Ronald Reagan's death and how he said, tear down this wall. But in spite of a strong international legal condemnation of this structure, we continue to let it exist today. The structure was built with little regard for how Palestinian life operates, and the most direct effect is Palestinians who are trapped between the barrier and the Green Line. They're estimated to be 50,000 people, nearly 38 villages, that'll be cut off by the barrier by the time of its completion. UNRWA estimates that 10.1% of the most fertile land of the West Bank actually lies in the part that's being annexed to Israel. And that doesn't even include the 250,000 Palestinians that are now effectively separated from their families and, in many cases, in the West Bank proper that live in East Jerusalem. So this barrier separates family from family, families from their farms, and confiscates land. It also separates people from their schools and people from hospitals and water resources. So to give you a sense of the effect on a Palestinian village, I want to talk about one that I've visited twice myself, which is the Palestinian town of Qalqilia. Now this town, as you'll see, is literally encircled by the structure. I mean, you literally see how it's gone completely around the town of Qalqilia, and it's had devastating effects. It has had devastating effects on the town. So, for example, unemployment right after the wall was built was nearly 60 to 70%. It became essentially a ghost town. At the height of the occupation, there was only a single opening that allowed residents to enter and exit this town, which would be open 3 times a day for 15 minutes. When I went back in 2010, this past summer, it actually had opened up and didn't have similar time restrictions. But imagine you live in a town like this. And so why did Israel draw the wall like this? You know, it's not intuitive. Why would you literally encircle a town like this? Well, if you look at the map, you'll understand that the strategic water resources are located in this area. So the route of the wall was very consciously drawn to annex these water resources. But you can also see the effect on Palestinian families, where many cases are separated from hospitals and schools. So based on this, we call for the university to divest from companies that are involved in the construction and maintenance of this barrier. So to give you two practical examples of companies we're calling for divestment from, one is the Dutch company of Rewal. Now, Rewal provides cranes and equipment that's been used to build the wall. And it's continued its sales despite the fact that the foreign minister has twice called on the company to cease its operations in the territories. The next company is Roadstone Holdings, which is an Irish company, actually, that has basically a monopoly on the cement industry in Israel, as it owns a 25% holding in Israeli Meshav Initiating and Development, which is a holding company for Nashir Cement. So it's using this concrete to basically build the wall, the one that we've been talking about, help build settlements, and help build the tram system I'm going to talk about later in the presentation. So third, we call on Stanford universities to divest from companies that facilitate acts of collective punishment, including home demolitions, land confiscations, and military activities against civilians. So of course, the most obvious recent example of this acts of collective punishment is Operation Cast Lead, where around 1,400 Palestinians and 13 Israelis were killed during a one-month span between 2008-2009. Out of the 1,400 Palestinian, 348 were children. Now, of course, much of the recent hoopla in the media has been about has Justice Goldstone retracted his report in the UN fact-finding mission, but overlooking the fact that the findings that the claim that's being talked about with Justice Goldstone is one aspect, which is the intentional targeting of civilians. But the report, which was subsequently Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and the National Lawyers Guild verified in their own investigation, documents other war crimes, including the deliberately disproportional attacks, the use of white phosphorus, destruction of civilian infrastructure, failure to distinguish between civilians and combatants, and much more. And just this morning in the Guardian newspaper, the other three authors of the UN fact-finding mission in Gaza wrote an op-ed standing by their conclusions. So again, the most visual example of Israel's acts of collective punishment, but it actually applies to much more than simply cast lead. We sometimes lose track in talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict of the fact that Palestinians live under a military occupation. They're an occupied people. So a lot of times there's a tendency, and you'll see this argument come up in the next few weeks as this campaign builds, that, well, we have two equal sides. Why should we, pick one side? Why are we just focusing on Israel's actions? But we forget that there's a fundamental difference between the occupier and the occupied. And international law strongly talks about the status of the Palestinian territories as occupied. And looking at the effect on children gives you just some perspective. Beit Salem, an Israeli human rights organization, documents that nearly 1,000 Palestinian children died from September 2000 to December 2008. And that's before Operation Cast Lead, just to give you a sense of, you know, normalcy before something like Operation Cast Lead. And there are all kinds of different anecdotes, including Raghda, who was a young Palestinian girl that was shot in the head as she was in a UN classroom in the Gaza Strip. Or Iman al-Hams, who had a little backpack on her way to school and was also shot multiple times. So we have to remember that collective punishment includes this everyday life that involves living under tanks and guns and gunfire. But of course, living under military occupation means other unfortunate realities. Now, this should be a pretty shocking statistic if for somebody who hasn't seen it before. But the fact is, most Palestinian families have had a member of their family detained. Currently, according to the Israeli Defense Forces, so, you know, take the numbers coming from that source, nearly 9,000 Palestinians are currently in detention, including 2,200 that have not been charged, and over 800 defined as, by the United Nations and Amnesty International as children. Both Human Rights Watch and the UN Committee Against Torture has faulted Israel for its use of torture on several occasions. Of course, Israel has also engaged in extrajudicial killings, you know, where it essentially kills, you know, a person they think is behind, you know, certain kinds of activities, and everybody who happens to unfortunately be in the same area. And Israel, especially when the situation becomes particularly difficult, regularly institutes curfews, where no one's allowed out of their home and entire towns are on lockdown mode. But there are other acts of collective punishment beyond just the military and the military detention side, and they involve things that, again, occur on everyday life. One aspect is home demolitions. Now, Israel does home demolitions for different reasons. Part of them are to demolish paths for the security barrier when it was building it. Some of them are for administrative reasons. So, for example, when Israel, you know, will say a home doesn't have a permit. In some cases, they do it for security reason. But the problem is not in what they do, but in how they do it. In many cases, they tear down entire complexes because of concerns about maybe one unit. And in many cases, little or no advanced warning is given to Palestinians. So there have been many documented instances in which people have died in their homes or have lost all their possessions when bulldozers have come. And of course, you know, Rachel Corrie, an American back in 2003, actually died as a bulldozer ran her over on the way to demolish a home. Now, these statistics, of course, are pretty glaring, and the first one comes from the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions. The second one, which talks about land confiscation, just gives you a sense of how pervasive these effects are. And, of course, the third act of collective punishment of sorts is the destruction of trees. And these images give you a sense of the Palestinian town of Budros, which was the trees were all demolished to make room for the security barrier that was built through this land. So based on these acts of collective punishment, we call on the Board of Trustees of Stanford University to divest from companies that facilitate acts of collective punishment, including those that we've mentioned. So to give you two examples, the first is Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin sells AGM-114 Hellfire missiles to Israel. Now, Human Rights Watch has documented its use. Lockheed Martin is the biggest supplier of weapons to Israel. It's made $4.4 billion off its missile sales and fighter planes. Also, according to a military trade publication, it provides Israel with its Merkava tanks, which we saw were used in Operation Cast Lead and often are used in incursions on Palestinian territories. Secondly, we call for divestment from Caterpillar bulldozers, which custom makes D9 bulldozers to destroy homes and clear Palestinian land for settlements and to build the wall. So both of these companies, I should mention again, are involved in the occupied territories, supporting an illegal occupation, abusing human rights, and in violation of international law. Our final criteria focuses on the situation outside of the occupied territories. It looks at the situation within Israel proper and companies that institutionally discriminate against religious, ethnic, or racial minorities. Of course, you don't need me to tell you that there is strong international law against discrimination, especially institutional discrimination, including the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination and the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So when we look at the situation within Israel, it's important to remember something, which is that Israel's basic law of human dignity, one of the 11 documents that make up the Israeli constitution, defines the state as a Jewish state instead of a state of its citizens. And even the State Department, in its 2010 report, which was issued yesterday, documents the institutional discrimination that takes place against both non-Jews within Israel and also against other Jewish communities that are not of European Jewish descent. Israeli Arabs, or the term that's used to describe Palestinians who did not flee their homes in 1948 and constitute 20% of the population of Israel currently, represent the principal victims of these policies. Israeli policy is often meant to maintain a Jewish majority against a Palestinian demographic time bomb, as has been used. In fact, according to current Israeli President Shimon Peres, the withdrawal, disengagement from Gaza was done for demography. That was the major motivation. Now imagine if Texas undertook policies to maintain a white majority in the face of a growing Hispanic population. We would call that racist. Yet we continue to tolerate a government who's explicitly made its policy and its orientation of government around demography. So, of course, there are many laws on the book that spell out this discriminatory system. So the first is the fact that under the law of return, Israel grants automatic citizenship to Jews from anywhere around the world upon request. And they actually, in fact, actively recruit immigrants to come to Israel, but denies the same right to Palestinians and refuses to allow refugees to return to their homes. So to give you an example, tomorrow a Jewish American can go to Israel and become a citizen on the spot. Whereas Palestinian refugees who have been languishing for over six decades in refugee camps across the Middle East are denied this very right solely on the basis of their ethnic background. Palestinians constitute one-third of the world's refugees, over 4 million according to UNRWA, and many resolutions have reaffirmed their right to return. But beyond just immigration, beyond just these kind of immigration policies, there's their land policy. According to a New York Times article, I think from 2002 or 2003, nearly 91% of the Israeli land cannot be sold to Israeli Arabs, right? In a subsection of that land, because a lot of it is operated by the Jewish National Fund, but even a subsection of that land can't even be leased to non-Jews. But this inequality extends also to the schooling system and to everyday life. So Jewish Israelis and Israeli Arabs generally attend different school systems that often don't receive the same amount of resources. Again, the racial discrimination isn't written into law per se, but it often becomes a de facto practice that especially occurs with resource allocation. Beyond that, the fact remains that there are nearly 40 Palestinian villages in Israel that are not recognized by the Israeli government. So non-recognition means that they lack, in many cases, electricity, sewage, and running water. So in many cases, you'll have largely Israeli Arab towns that are but kilometers away from main Israeli centers but don't receive basic services. And so the effect has really been staggering. So according to the Arab Center for Alternative Planning in Haifa, the level of education of Israeli Arabs is lower than those of Palestinians living under military occupation. And just to give you a current sense, it's lower than even that in Libya, which has been run by Muammar Gaddafi for over 40 years, right? So just to give you a sense, and the Human Development Index of Israeli Arabs is 44 slots below those of Israel. So again, I don't think this is people not being born as smart. This is a clear policy of unjust resource allocation. But this discrimination even extends to marriage laws. So Israelis can marry anybody in the world, and the next day they'll become citizens of Israel, except Palestinians. Israeli marriage laws, again, prevent Israelis from marrying a Palestinian and allowing them to gain citizenship or even residency. So given these criteria, we call in our final criteria for divestment from companies that institutionally discriminate on the basis of ethnicity, language, or religion. So to give you two examples, Viola Transport, which is actually a company that operates the Marguerite bus system here at Stanford, actually is building a tram line that would connect Israeli settlements with Israel proper. Now, this tram line does two things. First of all, it would be explicitly Israeli only. It would not be allowed to be used by Palestinians who live in the occupied territories. And secondly, it's often being built on confiscated Palestinian land. Secondly, we call for divestment from Mikarot. Mikarot is the Israeli public-owned water company. Now, water in the occupied territories, Israeli settlers on average receive over 5 times the amount of water than Palestinians in the territories. So what that means in many cases, and I've seen it having been there, you'll have Israeli settlements that have swimming pools, whereas Palestinians living kilometers away sometimes lack hot water to have a shower in the morning. It's also important to note that 115 settlements are located on water-sensitive areas and that Israel controls 80% of the water resources in both the West and the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel proper. So again, we call for divestment from these companies that are engaged in these discriminatory practices. So taking a step back and looking at our criteria, I want to emphasize two things. And if you got nothing out of this presentation, if you walked in a second ago, the two things we want you to get out of this more than anything else is that we're not calling for divestment from anything Israel. We're not calling for divestment, in fact, from the state itself. We're doing a selective, targeted campaign against mostly multinational corporations that are engaged in specific sets of activities that both violate international law and abuse human rights. We also asked the Board of Trustees, in addition to divesting from these 8 specific companies, to adopt these 4 criteria as indicative of causing substantial social harm, which is the university's definition of under its investment responsibility criteria for companies that it should not be invested in. And of course, the United Nations norms in both international and domestic law have strong prohibitions on the kinds of activities that companies can undertake. So before I wrap up, notes I want to make. Part of the reason we choose to focus on Israel, which is I know a question that will probably come up in the Q&A, is in part because of its violations of international law. Israel stands in violation of over 60 UN resolutions. Now that doesn't include the many UN resolutions that the United States has vetoed in Israel's behalf, and sections of the Geneva Convention, the ICJ ruling I mentioned, and countless other international treaties and other aspects of customary international law. But moreover, the reason why we single out Israel is because the U.S. government singles out Israel and the amount of foreign aid that Israel continues to receive. Since 1967, Israel has received over $85 billion in foreign aid, meaning that a country which is smaller than Hong Kong receives 1/3 of America's foreign aid budget, not including Afghanistan and Iraq, of course, and more than Africa and Latin America combined. So that's an amount of over $10 million a day that we give in foreign aid to a developed country that's engaged in illegal military occupation. So we here in the United States are sustaining the human rights violations that we documented. The other reason we focus on the example of Israel and Palestine is that we have a commitment, we've had a call issued by Palestinian civil society to undertake a campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. In 2005, 171 Palestinian NGOs, including some of those listed, came together and called on the international community, like it did with South Africa, to begin campaigns to pressure Israel to end its occupation and to bring peace to Israel and Palestine. So what's the Stanford connection? We've been talking about politics and foreign policy, international law. Why does it matter here at Stanford? The most direct way we're connected to Israel and Palestine is actually through our endowment. Our endowment began with Jan and Leland Stanford to act as capital that would provide a source of revenue for our institution. Our endowment as in 2010 stands at nearly $16 billion, one of the top endowments in the entire world. And Stanford has shown over the years, I think relatively compared to other universities, a very strong policy of investment responsibility, committing that if they judge a company's policies to cause substantial social injury, that it will begin a process to divest from these companies. So, of course, we began our campaign with an original divestment call back in January 2007. Now, this campaign got nearly 1,000 signatories. It received a majority vote in the ASSU Undergraduate Senate, and over 50, dozens of presentations were given around campus. And this campaign has continued to this date. But we are here today to renew our call for divestment. So to give you a little sense, I know my time is running towards an end, so not to go into this in depth, But what we're trying to do with our campaign is to trigger this process from starting. So the way that investment responsibility decisions are made at Stanford is the Stanford community can file a complaint to the Advisory Panel on Investment Responsibility, which in turn initiates a process by which divestment can take place. So we're really at this stage now. So we're trying to build a campaign among faculty, students, staff, and alumni to generate pressure that will lead to a recommendation that will eventually lead to a divestment decision. Of course, this decision that we hope the university will take is firmly rooted in Stanford's traditions and its ethical backgrounds. As Stanford students, you don't need me to remind you about Stanford's commitment to a better world, embodied in countless statements. But what it's important to talk about is why divestment? Why are we focusing on divestment? Divestment represents the most effective, nonviolent, moral way of affecting change. It deals with an area that we have direct control over. Our endowment is invested in the name of Stanford University, for which we as students have a say in that endowment. We're not talking about lobbying, writing letters. We're talking about something that we have in our hands to affect. Divestment is a powerful symbolic act that generates pressure to bring the stronger party to the negotiating table. But more importantly, divestment has worked in the past. Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, many of the leaders in the movement that ended apartheid in South Africa talked about how effective divestment can be in bringing about change. Here at Stanford, we have a strong history of standing strong on issues of investment responsibility. Stanford was heavily invested in apartheid South Africa to the tune of $200 million back in the 1980s and in 66 companies. After a strong campaign, these are images of campaign back in the 1980s, led by Stanford students, the university ultimately divested. And that helped raise the moral cost of continuing injustice and led to negotiations, which brought about the end of apartheid. But even more, as recently as 2005, Stanford divested from four companies that supported the Sudanese government in carrying out human rights abuses. This whole campaign took place in the course of only 3 months. But I want to draw attention to the quote of President Hennessy, because I think it really talks about why divestment. He establishes a clear link here between where we are invested and the university's principles. And that is the kind of message we want to remind President Hennessy and the Board of Trustees of. But even just last spring, we saw the university take a pretty revolutionary move, I think, in terms of divestment, where it responded to a student-led initiative in May 2010, and it led to the Board of Trustees adopting a set of principles involving the violence in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and our involvement in it. So the university again, so we saw in 1980s, 2005, 2010, a reaffirmation of the fact that we are concerned as a university about where we invest our money. Divestment in the context of Israel-Palestine is not something we're inventing here at Stanford. Yeah, we're known for entrepreneurs, but this is not something that, you know, we pulled out of a hat. In fact, it's a growing movement that has involved churches, unions, including the ones that are mentioned on the board, that have all taken a different form of divestment. Even at other university campuses, Hampshire College, you know, became one of the first university. Which actually divested from apartheid South Africa was Hampshire College. And they became the first universities to divest from investments in Israel and Palestine. Hampshire College actually took their criteria and a lot of their presentation from what we had done at Stanford in 2007. And it shows you just the kind of impact that we can have on the community. And we have divestment campaigns launched at many other universities. So what can we do? So what are we asking you to do today? You can sign our petition. It's online on our website. We want you to learn more about the conflict. Keep discussing this issue and spread the word. As a final kind of personal note, and this will really be it, and I'll stop talking. I want to talk about, many of you might be listening to this and saying, well, this sounds great, but this is just controversial. Do I want to get involved in something that's this controversial? What I want to remind you of is the fact that our criteria is built, again, on international law and human rights, and we're focusing on the actions of particular companies. So you can be pro-Israeli and be supportive of a campaign like this, just in the way you can be Sudanese and have supported divestment from Darfur, or you could be Egyptian and Libyan and support change in those countries that affects government policies. This campaign is about removing the root causes of the conflict and building a better future for both peoples. And I think part of that understanding that is to realize that all movements in history. Many movements have involved controversy. I mean, prophets in history were stoned. Leaders like Mandela and Gandhi were rebuffed and thrown into prison. The fact that a campaign is controversial reflects the seriousness of the system you're challenging and is not a reason for you not to get involved in the conflict. Remember that slavery in this country was once something that was controversial, and the answer to controversy isn't always taking the middle ground. Taking the middle ground in the context of American history led to African Americans being defined as three-fifths of a person when we wrote the United States Constitution. So when you sit and think about how you want to vote, how you want to stand on the issue of divestment, think of principles. Don't think of wanting to balance the tide between different campus groups. Every society has its challenge. Our predecessors had slavery, colonialism. After September 11th, and especially in the midst of this revolutionary wave, this is our challenge. Next month, the Israeli occupation enters its 44th year. It's the longest occupation on Earth. How long can we let it continue? Our objectives may seem impossible. Some of you might think this sounds great, it'll never happen. On January 25th, many told the Egyptian people when they took the streets that their struggle was also impossible. Nelson Mandela wrote in his autobiography that it always seems impossible until it's done. This campaign will face obstacles and not be easy, but as Mandela again reminds us in his book, there is no easy walk to freedom anywhere, and many of us will have to pass through the valley of the shadow of death again and again before we reach the mountaintops of our desires. With your help, we can help millions of Israelis and Palestinians reach the mountaintops of their desires. Thank you.